I do believe we have Barry on the line. Are you there, Barry?
I am. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you so much for joining us.
Pleasure.
So before we get into Brewer's Plate, let's give people a little bit of a background for you. So you're the lead strategy and designer at Hypnotic. Do you want to just tell people exactly what that is?
Sure. Hypnotic is a design company. We make marketing communications for what we call values-driven brands, basically people doing good things.
Mm-hmm.
Those break down into nonprofits, sort of social entrepreneurs, and what we call social intrapreneurs, people who work at maybe bigger corporations or organizations, but sort of have the wherewithal to make something interesting happen.
Okay.
And, yeah, so...
Well, I think Brewer's Plate probably seems to qualify for that. You're promoting a local charity based on called Green Thumbs Growing Kids.
Actually, Green Thumbs Growing Kids was last year.
Oh, was it? Am I going from the wrong one here? Well, my apologies. So if you want to, maybe I may have ended up with the wrong press release in front of me then. Do you want to just explain how this year's going to work?
Yeah. So I'll tell you a few things. First of all, you're right. It does definitely hit a whole bunch of the departments that we care about. It's first of all, supports local entrepreneurs, which we all know is a great way to keep money in local economies,
mm-hmm.
Specifically focused on food and beverage, but in Ontario, the food sector is huge, so that's a good thing. The second thing that it does is, again, it's because of the kinds of businesses it's supporting, is promoting better practices around food and farming. And the third thing that really matters to us about this is that the money goes to this year a charity called Not Far From the Tree.
Mm, yes, yes, of course. Now
you've heard of these guys?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think we've had someone on from them before. Yeah.
Okay. Should I give you any kind?
Oh,
of
sure. Yeah, please. If you want to just let the listeners know what they're doing as
well. Well, I mean, in short, they have a series of volunteers, too many even. Basically, they...
A rare problem in the not-for-profit charity sector. It's too many volunteers.
People are... Well, you know, you'll see why people are really excited to be a part of it, but they collect fruit. They harvest fruit from the city, urban, you know, our backyards, front yards, private property, public property, etc., and they divide what they take between the volunteers who pick that day, the people who own the property, and places that they donate it to. And so what the volunteers get, aside from, you know, feeding the hungry, this amazing fruit that would otherwise just turn into mulch on the ground, is fresh outdoor time, a little exercise, and a chance to, you know, connect with people, build some community. So that's why people love to do it.
Absolutely, yeah. It's one of those things I remember when I was growing up in my neighborhood. There was a lot of those the trees with the black berries on them that would stain all the stain all the concrete all the way up and down the street. And I was, even as a kid, I was like, man, I wish somebody would do something with this. So it sounds like somebody is.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, they've had years where they've harvested like 20,000 pounds of fruit. It's astronomical.
Wow. And this is all at this point. This is all from the city of Toronto.
This is all from the city of Toronto.
Wow. So let's take that and dial it back.
Sorry, when you said City of Toronto, you mean the GTA, right?
Yes, yeah. in the macro sense. So let's dial it back to sort of the theme of what exactly Brewer's Plate is. So you're sort of celebrating local food. There's definitely a local food aspect. These are all people who are local manufacturers and businesses. I see from, again, I believe I have last year's actually press release in front of me somehow, but some of the participants from last year were... involved with things like the Big Carrot and Mill Street Organic Beer. Do you want to talk about some?
Yeah, so there's 25 local craft brewers to start,
mm-hmm.
right? So these are, you know, members of a burgeoning craft beer movement in Ontario. You know, we all kind of grew up in this beer era where you have this polarized kind of Molson Labatt thing going on.
Mm.
But thankfully, in Ontario. I mean, as in a lot of places in the U.S. and Canada, but here it's just super strong. There's this movement growing of these hyper craft oriented entrepreneurs who make things that are actually delicious. So these people are motivated by making things that are interesting and dynamic and experimental or traditional, but like in a really rich sense. But not entirely motivated by trying to squeeze out, you know, the biggest bottom line they can at whatever expense. And so that's, you know, it's a pleasure supporting these kinds of people, and I really hope it grows. For one thing, because I've become a big beer fan over the last few years as people have introduced me to these things, and I've started to understand what it takes to make something delicious. But another, because again, they're all over the province, and if you stimulate these kinds of things, these are the people who hire people who work in their town. These are the people who buy from other people who make things around them. You know, we have all kinds of statistics that show what happens when small and medium-sized businesses are supported. They support many more people than the kind of larger big box or chain organizations that, you know, just kind of extract money from our local economies and put them in somebody else's pocket.
One of the interesting angles on that, actually, I was going to ask you another question, which I'll save for a minute from now, but you reminded me of something else that I remember hearing in class with regards to that issue that almost never gets brought up, but and I thought it was a really interesting perspective, which is the, you know, we're getting into areas where one of our many environmental concerns these days is fresh water, and talking about big factory farms in impoverished countries and that sort of thing, and about how, you know, most of what's in your food, like most people are aware of the fact that, like, lettuce, for instance, is, I don't know, like 99.9% water.
Mm-hmm.
But when you grow it, that water comes from the soil. So when you grow food in say, somewhere in Southern Africa or something, and then ship it to Europe, you're exporting, not just you're exporting a product with food that you can, you know, exchange money for, but you're actually exporting their water.
A resource.
Yeah.
Unequivocally. I've seen Maud Barlow from the Council of Canadians talk about this when we were trying to, you know, put the brakes on the mega quarry just outside Toronto.
Mm-hmm.
And, people don't realize it. You know, these companies that are, you know, canning, whether it's beer or water or whatever, around the world, are extracting that from people's ecosystems. And, you know, it's part of a cycle that goes up and comes down, you know, drains through, is filtered by the soil, ends up in their aquifers, and ends up coming back again to be used. And when we take it away and ship it somewhere else, that leaves there. Their ecosystem.
So we've talked about a couple of the benefits. We've talked about the economic benefits, of course, for local food. The issue there, of course, being that there's also an associated theory that if you know your farmer, your food's going to be safer. Which that is one of the sort of arguments that I'm not on board with. I mean, it doesn't necessarily mean so, but I think there is definitely something for the sort of. The aspect of that I do agree with is the aspect that when you're shopping for items in the store and your only connection to that food item is, say, Loblaws or whomever, Sobeys or whatever one of the kind of major stores is that it's if all your life all of your food comes from a supermarket, you have no concept of what goes into actually making food. And I think this is sort of part of the disconnect where people they aren't aware of these issues and they frankly don't care in a lot of cases because they don't have any concept of, well, you know, tomatoes come from Loblaws. Mm-hmm. Not from a field.
Yeah, I mean, you're touching on a whole bunch of issues there. You know, that system that you're talking about is part of a very, 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 very elaborate, fairy dust spraying, concept. Like, the idea is they're really, when you go into a grocery store or Loblaws, there are just a small handful of companies that actually own all of the brands that are in those on those shelves. And that's not just the packaged stuff. I mean, you know, but what is it? Four companies produce 85% of North America's meat.
Actually, we post it occasionally. I like to repost it because I think it's a great graphic. But graphic I believe you're referring to, and I've seen it. I've had it come up in some of my classes as well in the past, where they have all the kind of bubbles, and there's four main companies in the middle, and then that splits down to sub companies.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's things that people think of as brands that are just, and they don't realize they're actually subsidiaries, right? Like Kraft is a subsidiary of something else, and all these cases. And I think when you just look at that graphic, you really go, wow, I'm really buying everything I consume from like four companies.
Yeah, there are these multinationals that are really, you know, for them, brands are just pawns on a large chessboard. And they're doing everything that they possibly can to create margins at any expense, whether it's externalized, you know, somebody's being treated horribly somewhere else and not being paid, somebody's, they're destroying the environment somewhere else and turning it into something, or whether it's, just that they're creating the perception that you are incapable, you can't cook, you're incompetent, you have how modern marketing works, create a fear or create some sort of inequity, and maybe there's a market for it. So all of those things are, you know, really glossy packaging. So the theory behind shopping from a farmer or knowing the producers is you can look them in the eye. You can ask them what their practices are. You can learn a little bit about what it takes to put things in food that, that you know you would want there. You can use if you don't want to go to the trouble of that, or you can also use shorthand like do you know about Local Food Plus?
Mm-hmm.
So there's it's a great certification because it covers five, six things that you'd really want people to be thinking about if you knew about them. You know, how the soil is treated, how the laborers are treated, what exactly goes into the food. It's not strictly organic, but it pays attention to current research and uses third-party experts to vet. So there are people who are paying attention to these things, I don't want to give Loblaws a hard time, just using them as a euphemism for large grocery chains.
Oh, it's kind of like Kleenex, right? It's a brand that everybody just uses it as a shorthand. Yeah.
But these stores are basically, they're part of a large, matrix that they're trying to keep people asleep in, so that we just go to the store and think, it's bright, it's shiny, and look at all the choice we have, when that's really not the case.
Yeah, well, and I think it comes down to there's a sticky aspect that I like to emphasize whenever we get into corporation bashing, that it's not that nobody that's saying corporations shouldn't be trusted or in general you should be wary of corporations is not saying that
I'm a corporation.
That's one example, but thinking of multinationals and stuff like that and things like Kraft, is that not that you're not making an accusation that the individual executives are all evil and they're all trying to trick you. It's that which also doesn't mean that none of them are, but it just means that corporations are set up the way that corporations are set up. They are essentially amoralistic, not immoral, but amoralistic machines that are designed to create profit. And when you look at it from that sort of an angle about, well, this is just a system that's set up with incentives, and those incentives are maximizing profit, and profit is not linked to health or nutrition or any of those other things,
or to community development, or to anything even long-term beneficial to them.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know about B corporations?
No, actually, no.
So you might want to look this up, because this is a counterpoint to exactly what you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
There's a certification by a nonprofit called B Lab in the U.S. called B Corporation. My company, Hypnotica, is a B Corporation, and there are some 50 plus in Canada, 700 or so in the U.S. And these are corporations who are what's called purpose-driven. The idea is that they're ultimately working on something that's even bigger than their own bottom line. And so they can make long-term decisions. They can say, it's not about squeezing out quarterly profits, shareholder returns. It's about making this thing sort of a golden goose that gives back forever. And that may mean I invest in my community. That may mean I invest in the local environment. At the sort of giant brand names, level, you can, the players are people you might imagine, Ben & Jerry's, Patagonia, Method Brand, the great, beautifully designed packaging.
Mm-hmm.
And then there are tons of small organizations as well who have elected to apply for the certification. And in the U.S., I think there are some 17 states or something, maybe 13 states and another 17 in the pipeline that have adopted legislation to support these kinds of corporations.
Mm. Oh, no, that's very interesting.
Yeah, I think you'll...
We actually had an interview with Patagonia about 4 months ago, I think. So mm-hmm. If anybody's interested, I believe it made it on the cut on the new website. So if people are interested, maybe I'll try and find a link to that interview and put it on this week's show as well. But I think we could probably talk for hours on the incentive process of corporation. I'd like to let people know a little bit more about exactly your solution, which is not the solution, of course, but a place where people can sort of meet and learn about this and also enjoy some fine local beer and food. Do you want to tell us a little bit more about exactly what's happening this
year?
Yes.
So the Brewer's Plate is this year in the gorgeous CBC atrium on April 17th. There are, like I said, 25 craft brewers taking place. One of the things I love about it is it's the kind of a food and beverage event where you can actually stop and talk to people, right? There's somebody, this guy's pouring your beer, or this woman pouring your beer is probably the owner of the place, or somebody who actually works on crafting the product. And they're all about talking to you about what's in it, why it's special, et cetera. So it's really informative and fun, et cetera. It's not like you're getting into some big line and you're going to be jostled before you get a bite.
Sure.
Then there are at least 12 chefs, and some of those people, who's there this year?
I believe, if I'm not mistaken, you've got Chef Stefan Howard is on that list.
Yep.
He's the executive chef at my actual job, so I know him quite well.
Oh, that's hysterical. We have also partnerships with some schools there. We also have artisans will be there. I know. I think Choco Soul will be doing. I hope they're doing their beer floats again.
That sounds great.
Do you know these guys, Choco Soul?
I haven't heard of them. No.
Oh my goodness! Well, they're another one who's up your alley. Kind of a social enterprise, but basically a bicycle powered chocolate company. They have a horizontal trading relationship with farmers in Oaxaca, Mexico, and so they bring in directly their cacao beans, process them here into the originally traditional sense of chocolate. It's much more of like a superfood. It doesn't have any garbage in it that you wouldn't want to eat. That's the pure ingredients. They'll put in vanilla or coconut or things to sweeten it, but nothing. There are no strange chemicals on it you can't read.
So what, like, we talked a little bit about some of the reasons why the issues that that this event deals with are important, and you've told us a little bit about who's going to be there. What do you hope people will get out of it? What is your pitch to get people to actually come down? They're going to have some great food, and what do you hope that they
experience?
Well, here's
the thing. The stuff that you talk about on your show, it is in danger of being sort of kept in a microcosm, right? Mm-hmm. Like there are people who are aware of these things, and they're game to talk to you about the stuff for hours. Mm. As a marketer, I know that people are really busy and doing their best to filter out new messages, even ones that are important, because there are all kinds of important ones. Some people are dealing with cancer. Some people are just rushing everywhere trying to get their kids around. Some people are under stress from their job. We're all really busy. Events like this, I think, are critical, accessible gateways to the issues. It's amazingly innocuous. It's fun. You come. It's convivial. You get to enjoy the best ingredients, lovingly crafted by professionals and in the company of enthusiasts, and taste these things as well. And all of a sudden, you're talking to people, you're finding out what it takes to deliver these things, and you start to get some insight into the challenges that they face. And you start to realize, well, why can't I have this all the time? Why shouldn't tomatoes taste like this all the time? Why have I been buying beer in the beer store when it's owned by, this, multinationals, not even Canadian? I mean, I thought it was a government, an Ontario government store. It looks so crummy. Sorry.
I bumped into somebody at a hostel recently. It was from Czechoslovakia and was telling me, yeah, I tried some of your local beer. It's okay, but you should try the Czech stuff. And so I said, partially offended, but I wanted to keep my cool. I said, so what did you try? He's like, well, I had Molson Canadian and export. I was like, no. that's not Canadian beer. It's just called Canadian
not
beer.
Not Canadian beer. any more than most of the Pilsner that they're shipping, is the authentic Czech Pilsner anymore,
Mm-hmm. Well, I remember years ago, I forget what it was, there's a common beer where there's a big kerfuffle because they were being sold out to another a company in another country, and they lost like massive amounts of share just because the company was moving out of their country.
Mm-hmm. And it's interesting because I've poked around as you get hooked on these things and you start to learn about them, do your research. It's really interesting to see the conversations. NPR put out an infographic like 3 weeks ago that showed the 200 plus 300 world's most prominent beer brands that are actually owned by one of the two big beer companies.
Ah, wow.
And it was really interesting to see the conversations, because these are serious beer aficionados, people who really, they follow a brewery just for one special batch, and they try to get their hands on it, and they trade them and stuff. And what they were saying was, oh, it's such a shame about this brewery, they have integrity. I know that they got, where they got to because of their care for craft. I really hope they're not, forced to change their process, use cheaper ingredients, use less of these things, or water it down, And people still want to support their local beer. Even when after it gets bought up by a multinational. In our case here, it kind of goes against what we're working on. This is as much about supporting and sustaining local economies as it is about getting people to appreciate what it takes to grow better ingredients and to think about what they're eating, where it comes from, et cetera. When a small microbrewery does get bought up by a multinational, even if they're not changing their practices right away, they are... in spite of the fact that they're providing a few jobs, technically funneling that money out of our economy.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk a little bit about, you said what you hope for people is to provide like an atmosphere where people can talk about it. I think
an entry point, an accessible gateway. Yeah.
And I think, well, that's one of the key things that I've found is that just in my experience, you can't change someone's mind whose mind isn't ready to be changed. And I think that's what keeps a lot of people away from the environmental issues. It sounds very complicated. I don't know, my opinion is what for certain. And I have a lot of people who sound very certain telling me things. But it can be very disorienting and just put people off the entire subject. Mm-hmm. They're not ready to get a second job to learn about all the things they need to have an expert opinion on all these things. And so the reaction, I think, quite understandably, is just to ignore it. So do you feel like this is a good way to kind of ease people in? You don't have people standing by the door telling them what they must feel about
food. That's it. There are no pamphlets being handed out, et cetera. And just like you pointed out earlier with corporations, it's not like anybody who works for any corporation would kick a dog, right, on the way home.
We hope not, anyway.
Right, I mean, obviously, there's always a few. But
statistically speaking.
Right. And so most of us, I think, feel like the system is the way it is, right? It's become, things have started to happen the way they have over the last 50 years, in this really, really slow drip. And now we just live in this mindset that the economy, and specifically a growth-driven economy, is pretty much everything. And so, that's such a massive conversation to start with people that, of course, they're not going to want to, it's polarizing and it's just too much to ramp up around. Have a beer made by somebody who's really enthusiastic about it, who really loves it, who you can believe has done their best to procure the best ingredients. I mean, it's in their eyes, right? Share a plate from a chef who's, spent all this time training, and, nobody has any ideas about the glamours of working in the kitchen. It's a tough job at the best of times. And here they are handing you this plate of something they've lovingly crafted that you just couldn't make at home. It's going to be succulent and delectable. It's going to be, and they're going to give you a solid amount. You can walk around all evening and chat with people. I can't think of a more accessible place for you to stop and realize, wow, what would it take to get more of this?
Well, I think that's a hell of a pitch, Barry. It's been a pleasure having you on the air, although we are unfortunately out of time. Barry Martin is, of course, today talking about Brewer's Plate Toronto, which can be found at brewersplatetoronto.org, which you said was April 17th. Do you have a final message, and or would you like to let people know how they can get tickets?
Actually, you can get tickets right through the website, and that's probably the best way to do it. The venue is a gorgeous one, the CBC Atrium. I couldn't think of a better time to get your head around new, amazing, gorgeous craft beers than sort of the dawn of spring.
All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us. It's been a pleasure to talk to you, Barry.
Likewise.